Hello and thank you for downloading IASB Update. Over the next 20 minutes or so, we'll be providing a short summary of the proceedings of the IASB meeting, which took place between the 17th and 19th of June 2014 at the IASB's offices in London. I'm joined today by Alan Tashira, Senior Technical Director at the IASB, and Stephen Cooper, a member of the IASB. Thank you both for joining me again. I should point out before we begin that, as always, any views expressed during the course of this broadcast are those of the presenters and do not necessarily represent those of the IASB. So, to begin, only a relatively few topics to cover this month. We're going to begin with leases, Stephen.
Yeah, thanks, Chris. The IASB continued its re-deliberations of the second exposure draft in our leasing project. This month we talked about three issues. Firstly, subleases, then the lessee balance sheet presentation, and then the lessee cash flow presentation. In fact, that also included lessor presentation. Let me start off with subleases. So this is the issue of the accounting for the intermediate lessor in a sublease type situation. The ultimate lessor and the ultimate lessee would just apply the normal requirements. But there's the issue about how the intermediate lessor, who is both a lessee and a lessor, should account for the two transactions that it has. The key thing is whether there was some sort of netting that takes place here. The board decided that there shouldn't be, unless the requirements for netting the contracts are met, which would be rare. And therefore, the two leases would be accounted for gross, that is, the head lease and then the sublease. A key element in this is how to account for the sublease and the classification from a lessor's perspective for that sublease. And the issue is whether the reference in terms of deciding whether it meets the definition to be counted for as a type A or type B lease, whether one should refer to the underlying asset in terms of the transfer of risk and rewards, or whether one should refer to the right of use asset. The IASB decided that the reference should be to the right of use asset. So those were the key decisions in terms of subleases. Next balance sheet presentation, we had to decide how the right of use asset in the lessee's financial statements, in the lessee's balance sheet, and the associated lease liability should be presented and accounted for. The board decided that they should be presented as a separate line item, either on the face or separately presented in the note. So the right of use asset could be shown either as a separate line item on the face or could be amalgamated with the assets, the similar assets which are owned, so in other words, classified according to how the underlying asset would be classified. So if it's a right of use asset for PP&E, then it would go in the same PP&E heading as for owned assets, but then separately presented in the notes. Similar approach for the liability, that the lease liability arising in the lessee's balance sheet should be presented along with other similar liabilities, either separately identify the notes if they're presented with similar liabilities on the face or separately presented on the face. A more controversial area is cash flow presentation, not for lessors. Lessor cash income would always be accounted for within operating activities. That wasn't a difficult area, but the more problematical area is accounting by the lessees. At the moment, IFRS 7 allows a choice effectively for finance leases whereby the whole of the finance lease expense could be shown as an operating cash, as a financing cash flow, or the principal element of the lease payments could be shown as financing and the interest component of the cash payment could be shown as operating. So there's already a choice for finance leases. Operating leases, of course, at the moment would be an operating cash outflow. So now we are removing the distinction between finance leases and operating leases. The question was how to account for that cash expense. The board decided to apply the current principles that we have, the current approach we have for finance leases to all capitalized leases. So therefore, there is this choice of either showing the full lease payment as a financing outflow or splitting it between finance and an operating. that there is an issue that some lease cash outflows will still remain in operating. This would be, for example, the variable lease payments that aren't included in the right of use asset and lease liability, and also short-term leases that aren't required to be capitalized. In order to try and present a single measure of the cash outflow in respect of leasing, we decided that we would have an additional disclosure that would show the full amount of the cash payment arising from all lease contracts as a separate line item, as a separate disclosure, I should say, presented in the notes. And those were the three areas we discussed in leasing.
Great. Thank you, Stephen. Further updates on that project, obviously, in due course. Alan, conceptual framework.
Yeah, thanks, Chris. As you said, only a few major topics in this board meeting, but quite substantial discussions on them. I think conceptual framework was close to a day worth of board discussion. So the summary I give today is obviously going to be quite curtailed. I encourage people to look at ISB update as well. Now, conceptual framework, one of the issues we're looking at clearly is profit and loss and other comprehensive income. You know, during the agenda consultation and the development of the discussion paper, it's very clear that the importance of profit and loss is, I guess, a window into an entity that's reporting. And we've been discussing profit and loss, other comprehensive income, the concept of recycling and so on for quite a while now, and this was a further development here. We made some fairly important decisions at this meeting. Essentially, there will be a requirement to have profit or loss as a total or subtotal within the financial statements, and the board's described that as being the primary source of information about an entity's performance for the period. Of course, emphasising that it's not the only source of information, but certainly is a primary source. And the board acknowledges that there could be some components of other comprehensive income also provide information about performance as well. The board re-emphasised dual objectives for profit or loss. One is sort of more looking back or accountability, depicting the return an entity's made during the period, and the other is more forward-looking in terms of providing information that's helpful assessing future cash flows. So both of those objectives are important to the ISB. There will be a rebuttable presumption, given the importance of profit or loss, that all items of income and expense need to be included in profit or loss. In other words, if you think about income expense items, everything goes, for want of a better term, above the line. You can rebut the presumption, and one example that will be given within the exposure draft is a situation where you might think for income purposes you want to use something like amortized cost, but you want to, for the balance sheet or statement of financial position, to show a fair value, for example. So that bridging item, the difference between the two would go through other comprehensive income or OCI. The other is a second rebuttable presumption is that all items that have been included in OCI should be recycled back to profit or loss. Again, you can rebut the presumption, and what will be important now is that the staff are just going to do a little bit of additional work on those characteristics that cause you to rebut the presumption, to put things down to OCI, and also when you could rebut the presumption for items being recycled. So that's a very big part of conceptual framework. Also, just want to emphasise that dovetails in a little bit with the disclosure initiative and the work they're doing there, because I think when we developed the conceptual framework project, some people wanted us to go further with OCI and the classification. We're going as far as we think we can at this stage with the conceptual framework, and the disclosure initiative will pick up some aspects of that. We also had, I guess, more detailed discussions on components of the elements, particularly the asset. We discussed economic resources and benefits, and I think consistent with the way the framework's being developed, relatively high-level discussion on what economic resources and economic benefits comprise, not very much detail in there. That should be something that's done at the standards level. And similarly, there are some small things which are still important. The ISB's confirmed that the purpose of depreciation and amortisation is to depict consumption of the economic resource, and that's quite a different notion to being a proxy for fair value movements, for example. Sure. So those things are building in and getting a nice, strong, consistent flavour of the framework. The other two aspects of asset liability were executory contracts and, I think, relatedly, the unit of account. So we had a discussion on executory contracts, and the framework will state that an enforceable executory contract has both a right and an obligation, and essentially what you do is you combine those to constitute a single asset or liability. The board's conscious, though, that if you've got a forward contract, for example, to purchase a physical good, for example, it is possible that forward contract could give you control over the underlying asset. If that's the case, you do have to separate the two out. But normally, if you've got a forward contract, the asset is the right to buy the underlying resource, not the actual underlying resource. But we do know that the definition of control that we do have, it is possible that that option gives you sufficient rights to give you control. So that's being acknowledged in there as well. The board also noted as well, I think it's some people think that dealing with executive contracts would be a relatively big change, but I think it's implicit in a lot of our standards that we measure assets and liabilities of executive contracts in the same way. So essentially, they net off and you get a net of zero. And it's only really if the contract is onerous that we actually account for them. So I don't think we're going to see a significant change in the way information is being presented in relation to executory contracts. And the last bit is unit of account, and the framework itself will indicate that determining a unit of account is a standards level decision, but the framework will describe some possible units of account and also include some factors to help at the standards level. And perhaps the last, again, quite important issue is about presentation disclosure. The framework itself is going to include some principles to help the board in particular determine some disclosure principles that will give some consistency and clarity to disclosure requirements. For example, requiring that there's a clear statement of the purpose of particular disclosures in each of the standards. That's going to leave some of the application side, in other words, the guidance that is for preparers. I think that we'll be picking that up at more of the standards level. Some of the principles are we're trying to promote disclosure that's clear and useful and entity specific. We want it to be balanced and understandable and avoid duplication when we can. So a lot of those principles will be built into the drafting of the conceptual framework, and I think you'll see, as I said a little bit earlier, dovetailing in with the disclosure initiative, we'll see more standards level activity there. We had a close to a full day's discussion. We've got another day, I think, scheduled for July. So this is really is the core of our re-deliberations for framework at the moment.
Sure. I mean, obviously, it's a vast subject, Alan. In fact, thanks for going through it so concisely. Listeners might be interested in downloading the print version of IASB Update. It's available on our website from the top navigation, the Get Involved tab, and you'll see a clear link to it there. That gives a pretty comprehensive written summary of the proceedings of the meeting. So if this is an area of interest to you particularly, then please do download that, and it should be fairly useful. Anyway, thanks very much. Steve, back over to you. We're looking at insurance contracts.
Yeah, thank you. So we continued our discussions for the re-deliberations of the second insurance ED. We had four subjects this time, the first of which was an education session. The board didn't make decisions, and that's to do with participating contracts with participating features. The other three were more narrow scope areas. You remember that we had five major areas in the re-exposure, and these three areas that we discussed in addition weren't part of those five, but were issues that arose as a result of the exposure process, and the board did make decisions in those areas. Let me start off with the participating contracts. The board's had a couple of education sessions on this already, and the plan is that we will take a little bit longer over this particular subject. I think it's probably the most difficult of the five that we had within that exposure draft. So the board will take a little bit longer and won't be making final decisions on this until sometime after the summer months. The education session that we had was looking at an alternative approach to accounting for participating contracts, where we would adjust the contractual service margin for changes in the insurer's share of the underlying items, and or apply a book yield approach, which is to do with recognizing certain items within OCI, Now, the board hasn't discussed whether we should do this or not, and that decision will come later. But the board has been having education sessions to try and identify better what these approaches are and what the consequences are going to be. I did say that this was an education session, and that was largely the case. However, there were a couple of decisions making, and that is that if the board were to decide on adjusting the contractual service margin for changes in share of the underlying items, and if it were to use the so-called book yield approach, how would it scope those two? So how would it specify which contracts one would apply those two things to? So, for example, for the contractual service margin, we decided that if we were to adjust the CSM for the insurer share of the underlying items, we would only do so when the returns on those underlying items are passed to the policyholder, and they actually, the returns arise from items which are actually held. It can't be some sort of notional amount. That there must be a minimum amount that the entity must retain, and the policyholder must receive a substantial share of the total return in the underlying items. In other words, the entity would receive a relatively small part of that return. And for the book yield approach, we would only think of applying that if the returns passed to the policyholder arise from the underlying items the entity actually holds, and the policyholder will receive a substantial share of the total return in the underlying item. So this was sort of partly education to make sure that we fully understand these two possible modifications to accounting for insurance contracts, but also to just think about, if we were to do it, what the scope might be. I would emphasize, however, that the board has made no decisions as yet about how to account for contracts with participating features and whether or how to modify the approach that we have adopted for the non-participating contracts. As I say, those decisions won't be made for some time yet. Now, the three areas that we did make more firm decisions on were more narrow scope changes outside the five that we originally identified in the ED. The first one is to do with discount rates. The principle of having a discount rate which reflects the characteristics of the liability is an important one, and one that we've had really all the way through this project, and the board reaffirmed that principle today. Whilst we permit either a top-down or bottom-up approach to doing this, the principle is that the discount rate should reflect the characteristics of the liability and not the characteristics of the assets that might be held to fund that liability. However, in the exposure process, it became apparent that there was some confusion about exactly what this meant and some confusion over the wording that we had in the exposure draft. So the purpose of this session was just to identify those areas where we need to provide clarifications. Clarifications to ensure that we get some consistent application, to ensure that in circumstances where there are no observable or less observable inputs available from the market, that we clarify how an entity might then go about the process of estimating the appropriate discount rate to use in measuring that liability. The precise decisions we took are available in update, but suffice to say that it was really clarification of what had been intended within the exposure draft itself, and it was really all to do with how that is best explained. The second area is asymmetrical treatment of gains for reinsurance contracts. There was an issue in the exposure draft about how to deal with the gains and losses from reinsurance contracts compared with the gains and losses on the contracts which are being reinsured. And there was a situation where there could be an asymmetric treatment where a loss could be recognized on an insurance contract held because that contract goes onerous, but a gain wouldn't be recognized at the same time on a reinsurance contract, even though that reinsurance was covering for that loss. So we made a change to correct that misalignment, that asymmetrical treatment. And then lastly, the level of aggregation. The objective of the insurance contracts project is to make sure, is to ensure that the measurement principles that we're applying apply at the individual contract level. Now, whilst a lot of the work in insurance is done in terms of portfolios. The principle of the standard is that we should be measuring an individual insurance contract, and therefore we have to clarify those circumstances where looking at something on a portfolio basis is consistent with that objective of looking at individual insurance contracts. So we decided to add some further explanatory guidance to explain that. Also, we modified very slightly the definition of a portfolio of insurance contracts to be more consistent with that objective. So again, like with the first issue that I mentioned about discount rates, largely a clarification of what we've had in the exposure draft. And that was insurance.
Thanks, Stephen. So we look forward to the ISB continuing its deliberations in that project in next month's board meeting. So, Alan, we've been through the major projects. Perhaps you'd like to wrap up by just going through some of the other items, no less important, of course, on the agenda.
Yeah, thanks, Chris. I guess the two sort of sets here, one is the research projects and the other is more the maintenance side of it. On the maintenance, we had a look at some annual improvements, which essentially the board looked at the work that had been done by the Interpretations Committee and approved all of those changes to go through. And there's a small package of amendments to IFRS 2, that's to do with share-based payments. It's also been through the last stages. That's our sort of our due process to make sure people, the board's comfortable that it's considered all the issues before it moves to go to the next due process document. So those things went through, and there's sort of a list of the smaller items. The other one was the research side of it. We had three papers at this meeting on research. Two were done separately, one on discount rates. We have a project that we're going to be looking at how consistently we use discount rates within our standards, where the different types of objectives we have, for example, and you know, whether we have own credit or not built into the way we calculate a discount rate. And we're looking to put together a research paper essentially to identify whether we are consistent in the way we use things, whether we have some small drafting change we need to make, or something more fundamental. So really it's a good example of people have come to us and there's a perception that we don't use our discount rate consistently within standards. We're going to have a proper look at that, do a proper inventory and assess that. And again, because it's part of the research program, we're identifying to see where there's a problem. This is not just moving to towards an ED or changing the requirements.
Sure.
The other two were business combinations under common control. We're trying to do a relatively narrow scope project on that, particularly in relation to initial public offerings. And there's been a lot of call from emerging economies and from securities regulators to try and get some more consistency around the way that business combinations under common control are actually accounted for. And the third was actually discussed a little bit as part of the conceptual framework, and that was liabilities equity. As well as the liability equity split in the conceptual framework, we also have a project where we're trying to identify, I'd say more at a standards level, but it's still, again, it's exploratory, identify different models that we can have to get that split between liabilities and equity and what the consequences would be, and making sure we understand the different types of instruments that are out there that are causing us problems, for example. And ultimately, it's to see whether or not we should replace IAS 32, which is the classification standard, whether we should replace it or revise it, for example. Mm-hmm. So there's some exploratory work on that as well. And in July, just to give people a bit of a heads up, there will be a session that we've been working on more explicit criteria to prioritise our research program, and that will come back in July.
Fantastic. Thank you very much, Alan, and thank you, Stephen. So the next meeting of the ISB will be held on the 17th to the 25th of July. So that's the last meeting before our annual summer break in August. Also coming up, we've got the meeting of the IFRS Foundation Trustees, who will be getting together on the 8th and the 9th of July, again here in London. Until then, thanks for listening, and thanks for downloading. Thanks. Bye.